I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is March 8th, 2009. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's subject from the website of the Skeptical Dictionary is magical thinking. According to anthropologist Dr. Phillips Stevens, Jr., magical thinking involves several elements, including a belief in the interconnectedness of all things through forces and powers that transcend both physical and spiritual connections. Magical thinking invests special powers and forces in many things that are seen as symbols. According to Stevens, the vast majority of the world's peoples believe that there are real connections between the symbol and its reference, and that some real and potentially measurable power flows between them. He believes there is a neurobiological basis for this, though the specific content of any symbol is culturally determined. Not that some symbols aren't universal, for example, the egg, fire, water. Not that the egg, fire, or water symbolize the same things, though, in all cultures. One of the driving principles of magical thinking is the notion that things that resemble each other are causally connected in some way that defies scientific testing. This is called the law of similarity. Another driving principle is the belief that things that have been either in physical contact or in spatial or temporal association with other things retain a connection after they are separated. This is called the law of contagion. Think of relics of saints that are supposed to transfer spiritual energy. Think of psychic detectives claiming that they can get information about a missing person by touching an object that belongs to the person. That's called psychometry. Or think of the pet psychic who claims she can read your dog's mind by looking at a photo of the dog. Or think of Rupert Sheldrake's morphic resonance. Coincidentally, Sheldrake also studies psychic dogs. According to psychologist James Alcock, magical thinking is the interpreting of two closely occurring events as though one caused the other, without any concern for the causal link. For example, if you believe that crossing your fingers brought you good fortune, you have associated the act of finger crossing with the subsequent welcome event and imputed a causal link between the two. In this sense, magical thinking is the source of many superstitions. Alcock notes that because of our neurobiological makeup, we are prone to magical thinking, and that therefore critical thinking is often at a disadvantage. Think of the post hoc fallacy and the gambler's fallacy. Think of trying to make sense of or give meaning to coincidences. Zuzny and Jones define magical thinking as the belief that A. transfer of energy or information between physical systems may take place solely because of their similarity or contiguity in time and space, or B, that one's thoughts, words, or actions can achieve specific physical effects in a manner not governed by the principles of ordinary transmission of energy or information. Two of the more obvious examples of magical thinking are Jung's notion of synchronicity and Hahnemann's notion of homeopathy. Other examples would be applied kinesiology, graphology, palmistry, and psychokinesis. Other sciences have led us away from superstition and magical thinking. Parapsychology, on the other hand, tries to lead us into it. Dean Radin, a foremost apologist for parapsychology, notes that the concept that mind is primary over matter is deeply rooted in Eastern philosophy and ancient beliefs about magic. However, instead of saying that it is now time to move forward and give up magical thinking of childhood, He rebuffs Western science for rejecting such beliefs as mere superstition. Now for the science segment of the show. Today's topic, Beam Me Up, Scotty. From January 24th, 2009, scientists have come a bit closer to achieving the Star Trek feat of teleportation. No one is galaxy hopping or even beaming people around, but for the first time, information has been teleported between two separate atoms across a distance of a meter, which is about 1 yard. This is a significant milestone in a field known as quantum information processing. Teleportation is one of nature's most mysterious forms of transport. Quantum information, such as the spin of a particle or the polarization of a photon, is transferred from one place to another without traveling through any physical medium. It has previously been achieved between photons, which are units or quantums of electromagnetic radiation, such as light, over very large distances, between photons and ensembles of atoms, and between two nearby atoms through the intermediary action of a third. None of those, however, provides a feasible means of holding and managing quantum information over long distances. Now the team has succeeded in teleporting a quantum state directly from one atom to another over a meter. That capability is necessary for workable quantum information systems because they will require memory storage at both the sending and receiving ends of the transmission. In the January 23rd issue of the journal Science, the scientists report that by using their protocol, atom-to-atom teleported information can be recovered with perfect accuracy about 90% of the time, and that figure can be improved. Our system has the potential to form the basis for a large-scale quantum repeater that can network quantum memories over vast distances. Moreover, our methods can be used in conjunction with quantum bit operations to create a key component needed for quantum computation. A quantum computer could perform certain tasks, such as encryption-related calculations and searches of giant databases, considerably faster than conventional machines. The effort to devise a working model is a matter of intense interest worldwide. Physicist Richard Feynman is quoted as having said that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics. Or sometimes he is cited thusly, I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics. Nonetheless, here is how the University of Maryland describes Monroe's work. Teleportation works because of a remarkable quantum phenomena called entanglement, which only occurs on the atomic and subatomic scale. Once two objects are put in an entangled state, their properties are inextricably entwined. Although these properties are inherently unknowable until a measurement is made, measuring either one of the objects instantly determines the characteristics of the other, no matter how far apart they are. The team set out to entangle the quantum states of two individual ytterbium ions so that information embodied in the condition of one could be teleported to the other. Each ion was isolated in a separate high-vacuum trap, suspended in an invisible cage of electromagnetic fields, and surrounded by metal electrodes. The researchers identified two readily discernible ground states, those are the lowest energy states, of the ions that would serve as the alternative bit values of an atomic quantum bit, or, as it's called, qubit. Conventional electronic bits, short for binary digits, such as those in a personal computer, are always in one of two states, off or on, zero or one, high or low voltage, etc. Quantum bits, however, can be in some combination called a superposition of both states at the same time, like a coin that is simultaneously heads and tails, until a measurement is made. It is this phenomenon that gives quantum computation its extraordinary power. At the start of the experimental process, each ion, designated A and B, is initialized in a given ground state. Then ion A is irradiated with a specially tailored microwave burst from one of its cage electrodes, placing the ion in some desired superposition of the two qubit states, in effect writing into memory the information to be teleported. Immediately thereafter, both ions are excited by a picosecond, that is 1/1,000,000,000 of a second, laser pulse. The pulse duration is so short that each ion emits only a single photon as it sheds the energy gained by the laser and falls back to one or the other of the two qubit ground states. Depending on which one it falls into, the ion emits one of two kinds of photons of slightly different wavelengths, designated red and blue, that correspond to the two atomic qubit states. It is the relationship between those photons that will eventually provide the telltale signal that entanglement has occurred. Each emitted photon is captured by a lens, routed to a separate strand of fiber optic cable, and carried to a 50-50 beam splitter, where it is equally probable for the photon to pass straight through the splitter or to be reflected. On either side of the beam splitter are detectors that can record the arrival of a single photon. Before it reaches the beam splitter, each photon is an unknowable superposition of states. After encountering the beam splitter, however, each takes on specific characteristics. As a result, for each pair of photons, four color combinations are possible: blue-blue, red-red, blue-red, and red-blue, as well as one of two polarizations, horizontal or vertical. In nearly all of those variations, the photons either cancel each other out or both end up in the same detector. But there is one and only one combination in which both detectors will record a photon at exactly the same time. In that case, however, it is physically impossible to tell which ion produced which photon because it cannot be known whether the photon arriving at a detector passed through the beam splitter or was reflected by it. Thanks to the peculiar laws of quantum mechanics, that inherent uncertainty projects the ions into an entangled state. That is, each ion is in a superposition of the two possible qubit states. The simultaneous detection of photons at the detectors does not occur often, so the laser stimulus and photon emission process has to be repeated many thousands of times per second. But when a photon appears in each detector, it is an unambiguous signature of entanglement between the ions. When an entangled condition is identified, the scientists immediately take a measurement of ion A. The active measurement forces it out of superposition and into a definite condition, one of the two qubit states. But because ion A's state is irreversibly tied to ion B's, the measurement also forces B into the complementary state, depending on which state ion A is found in. The researchers now know precisely what kind of microwave pulse to apply to ion B in order to recover the exact information that has been written to ion A by the original microwave burst. Doing so results in the accurate teleportation of the information. What distinguishes this outcome as teleportation rather than any other form of communication is that no information pertaining to the original memory actually passes between ion A and ion B. Instead, the information disappears when ion A is measured and reappears when the microwave pulse is applied to ion B. One particularly attractive aspect to our method is that it combines the unique advantages of both photons and atoms, says Monroe. Photons are ideal for transferring information fast over long distances, whereas atoms offer a valuable medium for long-lived quantum memory. Also, the teleportation of quantum information in this way could form the basis of a new type of quantum internet that could outperform any conventional type of classical network for certain tasks. The work was supported by the Intelligence Advanced Research Project Activity Program under the U.S. Army Research Office contract, and the National Science Foundation Physics Frontier Center at the Joint Quantum Institute. And now the arena goes abroad. Today we go to Thailand. This story from January 19, 2009. Australian writer Harry Nicolaides has been sentenced to 3 years in a Thai jail for insulting the monarchy. Nicolaides wrote a novel 4 years ago which contained a brief passage referring to an unnamed crown prince. It sold just 7 copies. He admitted the charge of insulting the royal family, but said he was unaware he was committing an offense. Thailand's monarchy is sheltered from public debate by some of the world's most stringent laws. Harry Nicolaides was arrested as he was leaving the country last August. His self-published book, called Verisimilitude, was hardly well received. In fact, the only copy which is still known to exist sits on the shelf of the Thai National Library, freely available to the public. Shackled in leg irons and wearing standard-issue prison pajamas, Nicolaides pleaded guilty to the charges against him at Bangkok's criminal court on Monday. He was quickly found guilty, with a judge telling the court, "He has written a book that slandered the king, the crown prince in Thailand, and the monarchy." The court initially sentenced him to 6 years in jail, but reduced the term because of his guilty plea. Before the trial, Nicolaides had seemed stunned by what was happening to him, describing it like a bad dream. But he is just one of a growing number of people being investigated and charged under Thailand's draconian lese majeste law, as the police and army try to suppress what they fear is a rising tide of anti-monarchy sentiment. More than 3,000 websites have now been blocked, and one political activist was jailed for 6 years in November for an anti-monarchy speech she made just a stone's throw from the old royal palace last July. Several other people are now awaiting trial. As a repentant foreigner, Harry Nicolaides does at least have a good chance of being pardoned by the king, according to the BBC correspondent in Bangkok. The king did the same for a Swiss man given a 10-year sentence 2 years ago for defacing his portrait. And now for the final segment of the show, famous quotes. Today, Hermann Goering, born 1893, died 1946 at the age of 53. Goering was a German politician, military leader, and a leading member of the Nazi Party. Among many offices, he was Hitler's designated successor and commander of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. With 22 confirmed kills as a fighter pilot, he was a veteran of the First World War and recipient of the coveted Blue Max Award. He was the last commander of the Red Baron Air Squadron. Following the end of the Second World War, Goering was convicted of war crimes and crimes against humanity at the Nuremberg trials. He was sentenced to death by hanging, but committed suicide the night before he was due to be hanged. And now for the quote from Hermann Goering. "Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia, nor in England, nor in America, nor in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is to tell them they are being attacked, and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country."
Are you ready, Bruce? Start walking.